This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another, then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that he might try you by what he has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and he is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A look at our top stories this hour. The UN says at least 636 civilians have been killed in the Ukraine conflict so far, and over 2.8 million have fled the country. A new study shows half of the British children will go without basic items such as food and clothing from next month due to soaring energy prices. Also, the UN Human Rights Chief condemned Saudi Arabia's mass execution of 81 people in a single day, saying it may amount to war crimes in the absence of fair trials. Thank you for joining us. Well, let's go quickly through the latest developments in Ukraine, which has now been the scene of 20 days of Russian military offensive. Ukrainian officials say at least 9 people were killed and 9 more wounded in an airstrike on a television tower in the northern Rivne region. To the east, Russia says 23 people were killed and 28 wounded when a Ukrainian missile exploded in the capital of the Donetsk region. So far, the UN has confirmed the death of at least 636 civilians, including 46 children. In Ukraine, the number of Ukrainian refugees fleeing the conflict has topped 2.8 million. Off the battlefield, Russia has rejected U.S. allegations that it has asked China for military assistance. Moscow says it has sufficient military clout to fulfill all of its aims in Ukraine in time and in full. On the diplomatic front, Kyiv says peace talks between Ukraine and Russia paused on Monday and will continue on Tuesday. Talks over the war in Ukraine have been held between the U.S. and China in Rome. Washington is reportedly concerned that Beijing is providing military support to Russia. Max Civilli has more in this report.
On Monday, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and China's top foreign policy officer Yang Jiechi met in Rome to hold talks over the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. The meeting took place behind closed doors and went on for 7 hours. No information was given to the media about the outcome. China has so far sought to portray itself as a neutral actor in the Ukraine crisis. However, Washington fears Beijing's willingness to take Russia's side following claims by a senior U.S. official that Moscow has asked China for military assistance. At the end of the meeting, a U.S. senior administration officer said Sullivan warned the Chinese top diplomat about the unity of the United States and its allies and partners in their efforts to stop Russia.
We believe that the response promptly given from all NATO allies are fully adequate to dispel any possible doubts about the alliance's determination to take the necessary steps to ensure the security of its citizens and its democracies.
China has responded to the U.S., saying reports that Russia has asked Beijing for military assistance for its Ukraine campaign are U.S. disinformation. Talks over the conflict in Ukraine were also held in the Italian capital between U.S. officials and Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi's diplomatic advisers. According to some Italian media, Rome has so far played a minor role in the EU's management of the Ukraine crisis.
Italy always plays a minor role in all U.S. and NATO initiatives, even though its importance is crucial considering that 12,000 U.S. soldiers are deployed on our territory and some 100 nuclear missiles. Having said that, Italy is practically at war with Russia after sending weapons to Ukraine.
Meanwhile, Italy's health ministry announced Monday that around 35,000 Ukrainian refugees have arrived in the country so far. Most of them are women and children who have reached Italy through the border with Slovenia. Max Civilli, Rome.
At the UN, Russia has accused Ukrainian nationalists of planning false flag chemical attacks to put their blame on Moscow and inflame the situation further. Russian envoy Vasily Nebenzia described armed nationalists in Ukraine as the main threat to civilians there. He said the groups have been unleashing terror against their own compatriots by placing artilleries close to residential buildings, schools, and kindergartens. Nebenzia added the Ukrainian nationalists are openly flaunting their cruelty by posting videos showing the torture of captured Russian soldiers. He also criticized the UN for its silence on the crimes being committed by Kyiv and the Donbass region. Nebenzia said the Ukrainian military has killed more than 13,000 people in the region since 2014. Iran's foreign minister says the country supports any diplomatic effort aimed at bringing an end to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. In a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian underscored Iran's opposition to war, whether it be in Ukraine, Afghanistan, or Yemen. He described as important the recent meeting between the top Ukrainian and Russian diplomats in Turkey and called for the continuation and intensification of the diplomatic endeavors. Amir Abdullahian pointed to Iran's dispatch of humanitarian aid for Ukrainian refugees on the Polish border, saying Iran is also in coordination with Warsaw to station a Red Crescent medical team there. Dmitry Kuleba, for his part, appreciated Iran's stance and efforts, stressing that Kyiv seeks an end to the conflict. He also vowed that Ukraine would do its utmost to protect diplomatic sites, including those belonging to Iran. Soaring living costs are taking their toll on the Brits. A report warns that a third of UK households will not be able to pay for essentials, including food, heating, and clothing, by next month. A research by the New Economics Foundation think tank found that over 23 million people in Britain will be short by more than £8,500 a year for income. That includes nearly half of all children in the UK. Britons have already been hit hard by the highest inflation in decades. They will face added strain from April when the government increases a workers' tax and a cap on domestic gas and electricity bill is raised. Britain's cost of living crisis could deteriorate still further as Russia's offensive in Ukraine has sent oil prices surging close to record highs. And concerns are growing over the distressing situation of the Yemeni people. Now the UN warns the number of Yemenis grappling with famine in the country is projected to jump fivefold this year. In a joint statement, three of the UN's agencies said the number of Yemenis facing acute food insecurity is expected to rise to over 160,000. The agencies labeled the sharp rise extremely worrying. The statement also referred to a five-level ranking of food security. According to the classification, Yemen is level 5, which is equivalent to a catastrophe. Saudi-led war on Yemen has taken a heavy toll on civilians since 2015, with children bearing the brunt. The UN says over 2 million Yemeni children are acutely malnourished. The UN human rights chief has condemned Saudi Arabia's mass execution of a record 81 people in a single day and urged the kingdom to stop using the death penalty. Michelle Bachelet said the UN monitors indicate some of those executed were sentenced to death following unfair trials and for crimes that did not appear to meet the most serious crimes threshold as required under the international law. Bachelet said the implementation of the death sentence under these circumstances is prohibited by international human rights and humanitarian law and may amount to a war crime. She also urged Saudi authorities to bring the country's counterterrorism laws fully into line with global standards. Saudi Arabia has one of the world's highest execution rates. It often carries out death sentences by beheading. Tensions have once again escalated in the occupied territories. A short while ago, Israeli forces killed a Palestinian teenager during confrontations that took place at the Balata refugee camp east of Nablus. We're now crossing over to Ramallah, where our correspondent Mona Kandil is standing by and ready to tell us what exactly happened there. Mona, it's good to talk to you. So tell us more.
Up till the moment, it's not clear how this 17-year-old Nader Haytham Rayan was shot dead by Israeli forces in the refugee camp of Balata, East Nablus. But according to Palestinian paramedics, the 17-year-old Nader Haytham Rayan was shot in the head, in the chest and the abdomen, and he was transferred to Rafidia Hospital in Nablus. Then he succumbed to his injuries. According to Palestinian Ministry of Health, there are three other Palestinians were wounded in the same incident. One of them is was wounded and seriously, let's say, he's facing serious injuries, and he was transferred to a hospital as well. But we can say that usually Israeli forces raid the Palestinian refugee camps and Palestinian areas, Palestinian cities, in order to conduct arrests among the Palestinians. It could be one of these operations, especially that the Israeli forces raid these areas after midnight and in the early hours and before dawn, like what happened this day, to conduct arrests. The Israelis claim, as usual, that those whom the Israeli forces arrest are wanted for security reasons. It could be that during this operation to the Balata refugee camp, the Palestinian youths left their home in order to prevent the incursion to Balata refugee camp. And as usual, it's easy for the Israeli soldiers to be quick in pulling the trigger and shoot Palestinians. It would be easy for them to shoot and kill Palestinians instead of arresting them.
Thank you so much, Mona, for joining us. That was Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Moving on, several websites of the Israeli regime go down in an apparent cyber attack. Israeli media reported the websites of the Prime Minister's office and a number of other ministries were inaccessible following the attack. A source says it was the, quote, largest ever cyber attack against the regime. Israel's cyber regulatory has declared an emergency over the outages. Infrastructure, such as electric and water companies, are now being checked for potential harm. Civil society organizations hold a rally in Gaza to support thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. The demonstration comes as the Israeli regime escalates its oppressive measures against Palestinian prisoners. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon brings us more details from the besieged enclave.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip have attended a big rally in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. The event was organized by the Palestinian Non-Governmental Organizations Network. The network represents around 140 Palestinian civil society organizations. Protesting in front of the Red Cross office, people slammed the international silence in the face of the Palestinian prisoners' plight. Palestinian prisoners are facing inhumane and degrading conditions inside Israeli jails. They also suffer from prolonged solitary confinement and administrative detention.
We're calling on the international community to exert more pressure on Israel to respect the international law and the international humanitarian law, mainly the Fourth Geneva Convention related to the prisoners' rights inside the Israeli prisons. These prisoners are facing grave violations committed by the Israeli occupation forces.
Currently, around 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, are languishing inside Israeli jails.
We came here today to express our solidarity with the Palestinian prisoners, male and female prisoners in the Israeli prisons. So we are here want to send a message to the international community to make pressure on Israel to respect the human rights and the UN resolutions.
Israel's prison service continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners. Experts say that Tel Aviv's detention practices are inflicting great suffering on thousands of Palestinian prisoners.
We are calling the SRC in order to monitor and to observe these violations and to pressure the Israeli authorities to respect all the conventions and agreements related to the prisoners.
Prisoners' advocates have blamed the international community for applying double standards when it comes to the rights of Palestinians.
People here consider Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters who continue to suffer under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Iran's foreign minister says the resolution of the remaining issues in the ongoing talks in the Austrian capital for the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA depends on Washington's decision. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said negotiations in Vienna have not come to a halt, but a short pause has been announced in sync with the European Union's coordinator. Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone conversation with his Omani counterpart, Sayed Badr al-Busaidi. The Iranian foreign minister also said Tehran is serious about a good, reliable, and lasting agreement. Meanwhile, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has said all the pillars of the Islamic Republic work hard to preserve and advance national interests. Ali Shamkhani said Iran will remain in the talks until a strong agreement that meets all legal and logical demands is reached. So how big and serious are the remaining differences in the Vienna talks, and what areas are they in? Our correspondent Homa Liski explains.
We also had a brief, report of the process by Enrique Mora just before the pause, the EU coordinator. When he was addressing reporters, he also confirmed that now the main work of the agreement has been done. So when Josep Borrell, or the EU coordinator here in Vienna, Enrique Mora, say that there is a final text, I think what they basically mean is that most of the text has been worked out. So the issues that are remaining are not a lot, in it, the words of Mr. Mora, maybe two or three issues and not more, but they are key. And we're hearing that these are between Iran and the US when it comes to economic guarantees, when it comes to the scope of sanctions. They can be resolved, Iran says, if the decision is made by Washington to resolve them and to basically heed the demands that Iran has, because Iran wants an agreement that it can rely on for the foreseeable future. And Mr. Khatibzadeh, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, saying that if Washington says that they are ready and they've made the decision, we can come back to Vienna straight away and finalize or conclude these negotiations. We'll have to see if that's going to happen.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump headed to South Carolina for his latest rally on Saturday, 12th of March. But notably absent from the event was his former ambassador to the United Nations and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who was once considered a close ally of Donald Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Natalie Colarossi. The piece is titled, Trump Rally Without Nikki Haley Shows GOP Rifts in 2022 and 2024. Former U.S. President Donald Trump headed to South Carolina for his latest rally on Saturday, 12th of March, but notably absent from the event was his former ambassador to the United Nations and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who was once considered a close ally of Donald Trump. Donald Trump took the stage at the Florence Regional Airport at 7 p.m. on Saturday evening, in part to attack the state's GOP representatives, Tom Brice and Nancy Mace, and issue support for their opponents. However, the rally marked a notable divide within the GOP, since Nikki Haley moved to endorse Nancy Mace early on last month. The former governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, who is also weighing a 2024 presidential bid, threw her support behind Nancy Mace on 7th of February, which was just 2 days before Donald Trump announced he would emphatically back her primary challenger, Katie Arrington. Her endorsement of Nancy Mace has largely been viewed as yet another example of a fraction within the GOP seeking to move itself away from Donald Trump's influence. Since the 6th of January 2021 attacks on the U.S. Capitol, Nikki Haley has deliberately distanced herself from the former president, Donald Trump, at times. We need to acknowledge he let us down, she told the Politico website in an interview last year. Nikki Haley added, he went down a path he shouldn't have, and we shouldn't have followed him, and we shouldn't have listened to him. We can't let that ever happen again. Donald Trump, for his part, has made it a priority to support those who remain loyal to him in upcoming primary elections. His support for Katie Arrington came after Nancy Mace heavily criticized the Capitol riots and stated that Donald Trump's entire legacy was wiped out. Katie Arrington is running against an absolutely terrible candidate, Congresswoman Nancy Mace, whose remarks and attitude have been devastating for her community and not at all representative of the Republican Party, to which she has been very disloyal, Donald Trump said in his endorsement last month. Katie Arrington, on the other hand, is liked and respected and a true Republican, Trump added. House Representative Nancy Mace later fired back by stating that she believes she'll easily win re-election without Donald Trump's support. Ahead of Saturday's rally, Nikki Haley made it clear that she is not shying away from her support for Nancy Mace and headlined a fundraiser for her that raised approximately $300,000. Jumping in the middle of this and holding a fundraiser when President Trump is coming down here, that isn't keeping your powder dry, that's loading up your gun. Katon Donson, a former Republican Party chairman in South Carolina, told the New York Times on Friday. Meanwhile, Donald Trump released a statement on Friday in preparation for his big rally in South Carolina and again slammed Representative Nancy Mace for being absolutely horrendous. Nikki Haley, like Donald Trump, has been slated as a potential presidential candidate in 2024. However, while she has previously been a vocal critic of Donald Trump, she has never gone so far as to fully condemn or break ties with him, and has even suggested that she would not run against him for president. Political experts have noted that she is likely always staying mindful of how the GOP views Donald Trump. Nikki Haley's very smart. It'll never occur to me that she doesn't know exactly what she's doing, South Carolina's treasurer, Curtis Loftus, told the New York Times. Curtis Loftus added, if the political winds change for President Trump, she's prepared to be there, and this is part of that.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Images from the war in Ukraine have dominated the headlines over the last few weeks. But the Jewish identity of Ukraine's President Zelensky has been used by many in the West to cover NATO's clear alliance with neo-Nazi battalions in the war against Russia. But it's not just NATO that's working with these neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine. Israel is arming, and its military personnel are even fighting alongside explicitly neo-Nazi units. To find out more, I'll be speaking to a couple of experts after this report from Bianca Rahimi.
As the battle for Ukraine rages, we ask about the involvement of the Zionist regime in the conflict and any affinities between neo-Nazi currents in the Ukrainian military and the racist ideas inherent in the Zionist movement. The Zionist regime has supplied arms to the Ukraine military, including the Nazi Azov Battalion. Azov battalion members have been photographed toting Tivor rifles built by Israeli Military Industries, a subsidiary of Elbit Systems. In 2018, it was revealed that a Ukrainian military training school website indicates that training is provided by former Israeli Defense Force officers. Israelis have been confirmed as joining the fight against Russia, and Ukrainian Zionists from the extremist Chabad-Lubavitch sect have also signed up with the Ukraine military. The neo-Nazi Azov battalion reportedly included a number of Jewish recruits. But the connections with Zionism go much deeper. Numerous prominent Zionists hailed from the Ukraine, including two former chiefs of the Israel Defense Forces and five presidents or prime ministers of the Zionist entity. Odessa in southern Ukraine has been referred to as the Gates of Zion. For example, the revisionist Zionist leader Vladimir Jabotinsky hailed from Odessa. Jabotinsky historically supported the Ukrainian nationalists, including their leader Simon Petliura. Zionist sources today credit Petliura with responsibility for the deaths of 50,000 Jews in the pogroms in the 1920s. But Jabotinsky maintained that Petliura was not an anti-Semite, even going so far as to state, "When I die, you can write on my grave, this was the person who signed an agreement with Petliura." Following the Western-sponsored coup in Ukraine in 2014, a school was named after Jabotinsky in Odessa in 2016. The Ukrainian nationalists under Stepan Bandera collaborated with the Nazis in the 1939 to 1945 war. Today he is revered by the Ukrainian far right. The openly Nazi Azov battalion has now been incorporated into the Ukrainian armed forces. Much has been made of the fact that the president of the Ukraine, Zelensky, is Jewish, with the implication that he would not collaborate with Nazis. In fact, Zelensky is the protege of a powerful Ukrainian oligarch, Igor Kolomoisky. Kolomoisky, who has both Ukrainian and Israeli citizenship, owned Privat Bank, a company from which he is accused of looting more than $5 billion. Zelensky was the beneficiary of a network of shell companies set up to send cash from Kolomoisky offshore. Kolomoisky set up his own militia in 2014 and also funded the neo-Nazi Azov battalion. Zelensky has ceded power to the far right in Ukraine and now depends on them as frontline fighters. On March 1st, Zelensky again showed the practical alliance with the far right by appointing Colonel Maxim Marchinka as the new governor of Odessa. Marchinka was the commander of the neo-Nazi Adar Brigade, accused of Daesh-style war crimes in 2014. The Zionist regime and its supporters are intimately involved in Ukraine. Both historically and now, the Zionist movement is allied with the Ukrainian far right.
We're joined today by the British-Iraqi hip-hop artist and activist who's a patron of the Stop the War Coalition. Loki's also the host of the Watchdog podcast on Mint Press, which investigates secretive organisations and powerful vested interests. We'll hear from Loki in a moment. Our resident expert, David Miller, will also be giving us the benefit of his insights. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading scholarly critic of Israel. He co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Welcome to the show. Loki, I'm going to start with you. Can you tell us what's the relationship between Zelensky and the far right?
Well, essentially, Zelensky has overseen the integration into the Ukrainian state of several explicitly neo-Nazi movements. He awarded towards the end of the last year the Hero of Ukraine Award to one of the main fighters from the right sector organization, which is one of the Banderite organizations. In addition to that, he appointed as advisor to Commander-in-Chief of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, Dmitry Yurosh, another very visible fighter from the right sector. As was mentioned, he has appointed as the governor of Odessa, one of the Ida battalion. And overall, what we see here is a push to really put the Ukrainian state at the need of these major neo-Nazi groups.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, David, people talk about the fog of war, don't they? And an example of this is that Ukraine can't possibly have a problem with Nazis because the president's Jewish. What do you say to that?
I would say, you know, let's look back at his inaugural speech when he became president. And in there, in the official translation on the government website, he talks about Ukraine becoming like Israel and defending its native land. Now, of course, that's a very strongly Zionist thing to say, but it also points out the strong confluence there is between Zionist ideas and Ukrainian nationalist ideas. These are far-right ideas which depend on an ethno-conception of the state. And of course, these work very well with the far-right. So Zelensky himself, yes, he's Jewish. He's also, you know, strongly oriented towards Israel, but that in itself is a sign of being oriented really towards the far-right. And the evidence all, as Lukic has been saying, is that he has moved towards the far-right. He's tried politically to distance himself from them, but in practice, he depends on them as frontline fighters.
Loki, I mean, I wonder whether you could explain for our viewers what the relationship is between Zelensky and this oligarch, Igor Kolomoisky.
Well, Igor Kolomoisky, a triple citizen, even though it's illegal in Ukrainian law, of Ukraine, Cyprus, and the Israeli regime. He's also a citizen of that entity. Now, he was the backer of the TV shows, which Zelensky was a major star of, and he was able to take him from being that star to his landslide victory in the presidential election of 2019. He was the top funder of Zelensky. Now, what's interesting is in addition to funding Zelensky, Igor Kolomoisky funded the Azov battalion and the Idar battalion as well at the same time, essentially. The period of thrusting Zelensky in front of the masses on TV, Kolomoisky was also funding these explicitly right-wing and neo-Nazi groups.
Interesting. I mean, David, I mean, there's a lot of people on the left are saying words to the effect that, look, there's Nazis everywhere, so we shouldn't get hung up with a few Nazis in Ukraine. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, I've heard people say that. I've heard them say, look, the Nazis in Spain are doing well in the elections. Certainly there's Nazis in Russia, and there are Nazis in this country too, but none of them are in government. None of them are in prime positions in the military, in the police. The Azov Brigade's street army is deployed alongside the national police across the Ukraine. This is an army of thugs, which is there to intimidate anyone who steps out of line. And that means, of course, people who are seen to be Russian or pro-Russian. It probably also means, and it has been in terms of their ideology, Jews too. Although, of course, there are some Zionists who are fighting on the other side.
Interesting, yeah. And, Loki, is there a precedent for NATO, or even Israel for that matter, associating so closely with neo-Nazis? I mean, it seems extraordinary.
Well, I think the key point that was mentioned in the clip that you showed was about Vladimir Jabotinsky. This is not some minor fringe figure within the Zionist movement. There is no other figure in Zionist history who has more streets, more hotels, more cinemas, more parks, more schools named after them within occupied Palestine 48 than Vladimir Jabotinsky. Now, his followers went on to be the Stern Gang, the well-known terrorist organization that targeted British soldiers and Palestinians, of course, more. Well, in 1941, and this is historical fact, the Stern Gang wrote a letter to the Nazi government of Germany offering to enter the war on the Nazi side and supporting the Madagascar plan. There is a long history of this intertwining of the idea, as Theodor Herzl put it, that the anti-Semites of Europe will be the best friends of the Zionist movement because they will provide the Zionist movement with the human material through which the state can be built. It doesn't matter how people feel about it. These are historical facts about how we came to be where we are today.
Sure. That's really interesting, fascinating insight, Loki. And I wonder as well, so the question I'd just like to ask you is, what do you think explains why Israel's arming the Azov battalion with these Teva rifles? I mean, is it facing any kind of pushback for that?
Well, when you look at the general NATO policy of pumping Ukraine full of weapons since 2014, there, you know, Poroshenko, the coup, the president after the coup, the US-backed coup, said publicly on TV he thanked the Swedes, the British and the Americans for sending the weapons. NATO nations were generally pumping this area full of weapons in order to draw the Russian state into a quagmire. So when the Israeli regime sends the Tavor rifles to Azov, they are merely part of this general push which is taking place.
Yes, it's certainly a tangled web. And well, thanks very much indeed, both of you, for that. But we'll come back for a further discussion shortly. They gathered
from all corners. Chabad Lubavitch is an ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect with more than 10,000 emissaries in 100 countries worldwide. There are 52 centers in Ukraine and around 150 emissaries. Chabad is a dominant force in the Jewish community in Ukraine. Dnipro, Ukraine is the home to the largest Chabad, indeed the largest Jewish center in the world. Its benefactor was Ukrainian oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. But what is Chabad Lubavitch? Founded in the small Russian town of Lyubaveki near the border with Belarus, it is a messianic sect which believes Jews are the chosen people. According to Haaretz, Chabad's key religious texts state that non-Jews have only animal souls, not human souls. It runs a children's group called the Army of Hashem, which in the words of the leader of the sect, the Rebbe who died in 1994, is dedicated to waging war against non-Judaism. The supremacism of Chabad is nowhere more evident and pointed than in its activities in Palestine. A book called The King's Torah, written by two Chabadi rabbis from the notorious Yitzhar illegal settlement, justifies the killing of Palestinian children. It's not just words either. Chabad Lubavitch is heavily involved in the furthest extremes of the settler movement in Palestine. Chabad Lubavitch opposes returning any land at all to Palestinians, and according to the Zionist intelligence agency, Shin Bet, almost all price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians are carried out by followers of the sect. Chabad has links with the movement of the extremist Rabbi Meir Kahan, whose organization, the Jewish Defense League, was designated as a terrorist organization by the FBI. Chabad was reportedly implicated in funneling money from the US to Israel for Kahani. Today, it is deeply implicated in alleged fraud and embezzlement by Ukrainian oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. The Department of Justice has filed four separate actions against Kolomoisky, who is banned from entering the US. Two Chabad leaders are specifically named in the charges. Given this history, it's no surprise that Chabad Lubavitch is integral to the events in Ukraine and is aligned with a far-right Ukrainian nationalist.
David, what can you tell us about this mysterious Chabad Lubavitch sect and what's its role in the Zionist movement?
It performs a very interesting role. They have this thing called shluchim, which is a word for emissaries, and they send emissaries all around the world. They have 10,000 of them, they say, in 100 countries. And the role of the shluchim is to encourage people to return to Jewish religious practice and to return to certain forms of Orthodox practice. And it's used as a way of bringing people into to Zionism by encouraging religious observance, even for non-Orthodox Jews. In a way, it's a funny thing because they don't really regard Reform and liberal and progressive Jews as being real Jews, and it's an extraordinary sort of thing. But it's used to proselytize for the Zionist movement as well as for Orthodox Judaism, and it's of course leaned on by the Zionist movement more properly known. The Jewish Agency, for example, has adopted the same term shluchim for its emissaries, and it sends emissaries from Israel all across Britain and all across many other Western countries. And so it's used as a kind of cutting edge for expanding the influence of Zionism, even although it appears simply to be a religious organization.
Interesting. I mean, Even the infamous Zionist intelligence agency Shin Bet seems sceptical about Khabbad Lubavitch. I mean, why do you think its role in revenge attacks on Palestinians isn't better known? I mean, people need to be aware about this.
It's a truly extraordinary story, isn't it? These are people who are involved in daily attacks and humiliations of Palestinians. It's well known in Palestine that this is the case. The Zionist press regularly talks about it, and many of the things in the report you've just seen, the quotes come from Zionist press articles. But outside of Palestine, it's regarded as being a sort of cuddly and interesting Jewish local organization which will bring you in for a Shabbat supper and will be nice to local Jews and indeed to non-Jews. Mm. But actually, you know, when you look a little bit deeper, the theology underlying this, you saw that in the clip just there, the idea of a war against non-Judaism. It's a little bit frightening when people begin to think of that, how that might relate to the attacks on Palestinians, but also how that might relate to the views of this organization in terms of people in this country. So it's extremely surprising, really, when you see this, that hardly anybody in this country has any idea that this is the kind of organization it is.
Well, hopefully what we're doing today will have illuminated a few more people. But look, I mean, the FBI's banned the Ukrainian oligarch Kolomoyskyi and his family from the US and named two senior Chabad leaders as being intimately involved in his alleged looting and fraud in the United States. But how does that relate, do you think, to the conflict in Ukraine?
Well, the money, over $5 billion, it said, was looted by Kolomoyskyi from a bank. This is only from the bank we're talking about. And it was done by a network of shell companies, which President Zelensky also benefited from. But these two guys, the Chabad guys in Florida, who've taken millions and millions of dollars, spread it around real estate and spread it around Chabadi charities in New York and indeed in Florida. This has been a means to get the money out of Ukraine. So it's been a means which has contributed to the destabilization of Ukraine. So that's one way in which it has contributed. But it's also contributed in the sense that Kolomoyskyi is absolutely central to the encouragement of the neo-Nazis and the pursuit of the power of President Zelensky. So there's a very strong connection here between the Chabad movement, which of course is supported in the Ukraine by Kolomoyskyi, and the whole neo-Nazi question. So these are very closely connected, and you know, truly extraordinary as a picture of what's happening in Ukraine now.
Absolutely. I mean, Loki, I wonder whether you could sum up for us how you think this Kolomoyskyi network relates to NATO's activities in Ukraine.
Well, essentially, since 2008, at least, at the Bucharest summit, you had NATO put very clearly in their conclusions that Ukraine would join the alliance. This is black and white and available on the NATO website. When you look at this funneling of money into building up what would become the bulwark of the Ukrainian state against Russia, then you see quite clearly how Kolomoyskyi and NATO's interests have intertwined. It's also important to point out that historically it's been said that if we were to list every single former Nazi that worked with NATO, that was sort of subsumed into NATO following World War II, it would take something like 3,000 pages. For example, you look at Sidney Gottlieb and his innovative work in terms of torture and developing MK Ultra. It took place with a team of Nazi doctors and scientists. There's so many other examples of the way in which US policy has integrated into it Nazi figures. So really, this is not a historical aberration at all.
No, indeed. I mean, what do you think the end game is here, though? I mean, this is a...
What it seems to me...
We're on the precipice, aren't we, potentially of a third world war here. I mean, so, you know, what on earth is going on?
Well, you have a few contradictions happening. On one hand, if the United States has separated Russia off from Europe, essentially, meaning that US companies will benefit massively from now being the source of gas for Europe. They have sidelined the Nord Stream pipeline, which was a major objective of US companies, no doubt. But then also, in addition to that, they seek in the long term to, through these sanctions, bring down the Russian government and either balkanize Russia or potentially, it's been said in recent days, integrate Russia into NATO itself. The other side, which may harm US interests, is of course when you push something like 3 billion people in Russia, India, and China towards each other to trade in currencies other than dollars, what you have is quite serious ramifications economically for the United States. So it's quite a short-sighted policy, I would say.
I mean, those economic ramifications, David, I mean, they're also going to be felt potentially very acutely in Europe, aren't they? How have the political leaders taken leave of their senses? I mean, they're imposing these sanctions, but I've seen various commentators say that these are going to blow back on European citizens, on British citizens, with higher energy prices, higher food prices, and potential shortages of both. I mean, is the truth of that? What do you think?
That's right. I mean, it will blow back. It will blow back in that sense, in the economic sense. It will lead to hardship in this country. Fuel prices will increase, and that will be a significant effect. There will be blowback in terms of the neo-Nazis, of people who've gone to fight there, who come back to this country and will commit to attacks like has been the case in the past, where the Ukrainian terrorists in this country have killed people, including, for example, the well-known campaigner Maz Salim. Her father was killed by a Ukrainian neo-Nazi. But also, I think the other question, which Karim touched on, is that this is about the possibility of ending a unipolar world. You push those people together, maybe they'll be joined by Venezuela, Iran, by Bolivia, by Cuba, and then you've got the beginnings of the end of the US empire. Once the SWIFT payment system, which has now been stopped in Russia, Russia's excluded from that, they will have to develop alternatives, alternative internet if they're censored, and that's going to lead potentially to the possibility of an emerging alternative power base which will challenge the US empire much more pointedly than this conflict has.
I mean, briefly, Loki, what do you think the future is then for the petrodollar as a result of this?
Well, I think it's inevitable that you will see major, major ramifications depending on what happens in Ukraine. I think that if you were right now sitting in the United States, what you would want was to increase this period of time. You know, Hillary Clinton actually put it this way: we are looking at the Afghanistan model. And when she means the Afghanistan model, she's talking about 1979, when the United States were able to draw the Soviet Union into occupation of Afghanistan. So really, they are working for a long-term goal, which I think will be hard for them to achieve, no matter how many javelin pieces of weaponry that they send in there, or the failed Starstreak. No matter how they try to encourage this quagmire, I don't think it's going to go on for quite as long as they hope it will. So it may well backfire.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks very much, both of you, David and Loki, for your illuminating insights. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis. So until next time on Palestine Declassified, bye for now.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., immigration activists and Democrats say there is a disconnect between President Biden's words at the lectern and the government's litigation in the courtroom. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Zolan Cano Youngs. The piece is titled "Biden Administration Fights in Court to Uphold Some Trump-era Immigration Policies." President Joe Biden promised to unravel the moral and national shame of the immigration policies enacted by President Donald J. Trump. But that was hardly the position that President Biden's lawyers took in a federal courtroom earlier this year. Appearing in January before a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, government lawyers urged the court to let President Biden enforce a restriction imposed by Donald Trump that allowed migrants to be quickly turned away at the border with Mexico. Judge Justin R. Walker, an appointee of Donald Trump, was confused. The same lawyers had argued just weeks earlier that enforcing a different Trump-era border rule would not align with the administration's values. Now they were essentially saying the opposite. What are we to make of this? Judge Walker asked. The answer is found in the collision of